Hello, I'm Alma Schneider. I'm a licensed clinical social worker and the proud mother of four children, one of whom has Prader-Willi syndrome.
And I am Iris Miller. I'm a certified rehabilitation counselor and the proud mother of two children, one of whom has quadriplegic cerebral palsy and is nonverbal.
In this podcast, we discuss the uncensored truth about raising children with disabilities.
Prepare to laugh, cry, and hopefully learn something new.
This is Two Moms, No Fluff. Hello, everyone, and welcome to Two Moms, No Fluff, the podcast where we discuss the uncensored truth about raising children with disabilities. I'm Alma Schneider, and I'm here with my wonderful friend and partner, Iris Miller. And we are very excited to be here with you, whether you're a longtime listener or this is your first time. Welcome and welcome back.
Hi, Alma. So nice to see you again. Alma, today I'm excited to talk about the topic of advocating within a disability program. Even though we are going to talk about advocating within a disability program, I think this episode is very important to anyone who is involved in programming, whether for people who are able-bodied or programs that are intended to be inclusive. And if you want to improve your program, listen in, because we would have some perfect tips for not just parents. So join us. And Alma, I don't know if you would like to start or want me to start.
Why don't you start?
Okay.
Your role.
Yeah, I think, Alma, in general, that we as parents of kids with disabilities, we always want our kids to be included and be a part of society, and the activities that are offered to other children are also important for our children. And sometimes, obviously, we get very kind of offended, I would use that word, when things don't work out for our child. If you can really, multiply that, it would be when there is a program that is specifically for kids with disabilities, but it doesn't include your own child. One way or another, we've all been there. And as insulting as it is, my main message in this episode is, do not take it personally. It's easier to say than to do, but don't take it personally. And if you are offended, and if you are angry and frustrated, take a deep breath and use all that energy, utilize the energy to help them improve. And we'll go in more details on how to do that when we continue this episode. Alma, back to you.
Yes, I can totally relate. It is extra, extra, extra painful to come to terms with the fact that your child requires a program for kids with disabilities, but then to be either not have your child be able to participate in the program or to be kicked out of the program that is meant for people with disabilities. It is a pain like no other. And so I'll give an example. I've unfortunately had to be in that position many a time, and it doesn't really get easier. I know that you said we need to take a deep breath and try to make it more inclusive, and we might get better at hiding our pain, but it's still there, and we just might be better able to control it and not spew our venom at the people on the other end. But it is really, really frustrating and really hard and really painful to have to advocate, especially when you're in a program already meant for kids with disabilities. So we really first experienced this in the public school system, unfortunately. That's the first place where I really experienced this. And it was very disturbing, very upsetting to have to explain to the staff in first grade, that the way that they were providing services for my son in the disability program was triggering him and causing him, his behavior to escalate to the point where he wasn't learning how to read because all he was doing was tantruming. And we were told that this is not good. He is tantruming every day. This is something that is, it's unacceptable that he's tantruming and saying mean things to the teachers. So the background I'll give you is that he was getting pulled out of class in order to supposedly learn better for reading and math. I figured out very quickly that the reason he was getting so upset and tantruming when they pulled him out was that he wanted to be with the other students. It's very important. It's always been very important for my son to be a part of the mix. And they were physically taking him out of the class and focusing on math and reading. And he was getting nothing accomplished because he was tantruming the whole time. So I furiously advocated for months and months for them to do what's called push in, where they give him that extra assistance in the classroom with the other kids there. And they fought me and they fought me and they fought me. And they said they wanted to do all these other interventions before they did that, like get a behavior analysis. I was like, he doesn't need a behaviorist to come in. I know what's going on. I know my child, and he is tantruming because he's being pulled out and he's being made to feel othered, you know? And they finally listened to me. And surprisingly, guess what happened? All the tantrums stopped and his reading levels went way up and everything was fine. So yes, the end result was that we got what we wanted, but not without a tremendous amount of advocacy and stress on my part. And it never should have happened. And it's another example of, you know, parents know best. They know their children best. They know, you know, we just know, our gut is telling us what the issue is. And to not be heard, and they're being in a program that is specifically for a child with a disability, it's very disheartening, because one would think that they are skilled at this and they're in this profession for a reason. They have experience, but it's not always the case. And we, you know, it's our plight to have to keep advocating even within a disability program, which seems extra upsetting.
Ay, Alma, what can I say? It's something that I think parents need to remember, that even in programs that are supposedly designed, and the word designed is used very loosely here, for children and sometimes adults with disabilities, the perspective and the offering is many times limited to the person who kind of came up with the idea, their perception, experience, and understanding of the concept of disability. Did a group of professionals really sit in to discuss all the different types of disabling conditions that can show up, you know, or manifest themselves in the children that register for the program? Many times not. I think one experience that our family had is with swim classes for children with disabilities. And I said, like, would I be able to bring my daughter who's quadriplegic? And they said, yes, no problem. Our instructors have worked with many kids with many disabilities. We have so many students here with autism. Now, if you know anything about quadriplegic cerebral palsy and autism, the manifestation is very, very different. And I think people don't really understand a person who cannot control their extremities at all or have any neck control. If you put my daughter unaided in the water, no matter if it's only like the knee level, she would drown. Like there is no way she can physically control anything of her body. And it's almost like funny to me sometimes that, like, yes, this is a program for children. Adults are not allowed with the children. We would help the children. And just, have you ever supported a person who's quadriplegic in the water? And then when you start asking them the questions and you go into the details, they start to understand and unwittingly sometimes admit that they don't know what they're talking about and they don't have the skills nor qualifications to handle your child's specific situation. Mm-hmm. The reason I'm telling you this is that I hope that people would kind of, again, walk into the interaction and walk into the situation on a day that they had a good night's sleep before, on a day that they feel that they are in a place of somewhat well-being, because I know in our lives, being in a place of well-being is sometimes extremely challenging and hard, but to go in with the most patience and tolerance that you can and really break it down, explain all unexpected behaviors that can happen to your child, let's say in the swimming pool. What would happen if someone would blow the whistle and your child is in the pool? How would they react? What would happen if someone touches them unexpectedly? How would your child be successful in learning? What can help your child be quiet or motivated or mm-hmm. Participate within a group? You need to give them as much information. And while you do that, don't just scare them out of offering that program to your child, but also give them ways to help you help them. In mm-hmm. our case, it was always, let's say, in swim classes, we had to physically go in the water with the instructors and hold and support our daughter in the water because nobody else could do it for us. And remember to help them help you. And we'll talk more about it later.
And that reminds me of, you know, that so much falls on us as parents. So yes, oftentimes we can get what our child needs, but the process can be so drawn out, so long, so having to kind of defend our argument in a way that these things are needed and show the extreme horrible things that can happen, like your daughter drowning, my son dying from overeating if they don't monitor him, things like this. The stakes are very high. They are very high sometimes. And it's exhausting to have to really push it when people don't accept what we have to say at face value. We have to really pound it into them that, no, this isn't just like our preference. This is an absolute need if you're going to have our child in your program. So so this leads me always back to self-care that, you know, and you kind of brought it up that make sure you have enough sleep the night before, that you're at your best when you're advocating for your kid, which isn't always possible. And that's why sometimes we lose it. And if we lose it sometimes, then cut yourself some slack and forgive yourself for losing it. Something that, you know, is very common for me is the food issue. Because my son does have Prader-Willi syndrome, it can be exhausting explaining to people who consider their programs to be inclusive, explaining to them that no, my child cannot be in this program if you have food sitting out on a, I don't care that it's on a shelf. If he sees it, he's going to be distracted. If you are not monitoring him, he can, you know, get food from elsewhere. So I really come into a lot of problems with that. People don't understand and I don't expect them to, because Prader-Willi syndrome is rare. It's not common. It's not commonly dealt with in a lot of these programs. It's 1 in 15,000. So I understand that I have to explain it to them. But what I don't appreciate is when it has been explained and it's not listened to.
Of course, yeah.
Yeah, so that's when it can be upsetting. And that actually happened very recently, where we had a program that my son was in, again, for children with disabilities, and he was able to get a lot of food, even though it was written in the paperwork that he needed to be monitored and that he could sneak. He ended up having to go to the hospital. And again, this was from a program for people with disabilities. And I was told that they can't be expected to monitor my son because there were a lot of kids in the program. Again, this was a program for people with disabilities. And if you are going to say, this is a program where we are accepting people with disabilities, let us know what your child's needs are. And then my son ends up in the hospital there's something and that the child couldn't be monitored, this is kind of serious, because this is not a program that is, it's one thing to be inclusive and to say, okay, you know, we let everybody in. It's another thing to take the disability seriously and follow what the parent is telling the program, that what the needs are, and then the needs not being met, because it can really become a terrible safety issue, where my son literally could have died from this experience. It can get very complicated, especially when we want our kids to continue being in these programs that they get a lot from. They benefit from a lot of programs that are inclusive, but we have to make sure that these programs are safe. And that's where the advocacy has to come in. That again, can be very emotionally exhausting and upsetting if we think that our kids are going into a program that is safe. We assume that these programs are going to be safe because they're geared toward people with disabilities. And then when they're not safe, it can cause a lot of parents to say, you know what, I have to be present at all times. I can't send my kids to programs, and it can lead a family to become they can live a very isolated existence, not participating in any program because we lose trust in the programs that are out there. So this has happened to us many times. I'll pass it over to you, Iris. I want to talk about some other experiences that I've had in programs that say that they're inclusive, but actually are not.
Yeah, Alma, this is, I think, the absolute most extreme of how programs can go wrong. Having a situation where a child's life is actually in danger because of lack of attention to the reasonable accommodations. It's the term is in the law, the reasonable accommodations that a child with a disability needs. It's extremely frustrating, scary, and just, you know, how would I say, the level of upsetness that you experienced is beyond me, like that could have even happened. I don't know how to help programs when it comes to paying attention to the details. But if a child has a severe allergy and they allow others to bring peanuts and that can cause death, then the equivalent would be in your situation being near food, and it can cause death in this situation because the reflex of vomiting after overeating is not there, and therefore it's really like clear as daylight why it can be or needs to be avoided. I really hope that anyone and everyone that is making an effort to offer someone for people with disabilities would know how to rate the needs of each and every member, and to know which are the red zone, the things that are very important, that are life-threatening, that they really do need to not compromise on, even for a second. And the other things maybe can take lesser of a priority, but when it comes to those crucial things that cannot be forgotten, let's say a kid who's allergic to bees cannot leave the classroom without the EpiPen, that should always be followed. I think the most basic of basics for programs like that. Mm-hmm. Now, I want to talk a little bit about something that is way less severe, less intimidating than the story that you just shared. But that is, you know, being prepared in terms of inclusion and being able to modify the program to fit different needs. Mm-hmm. So, as you know, because my daughter has such a kind of severe cerebral palsy, we didn't even try to attempt at the beginning to go to any classes that were meant for kids without disabilities. And when she was very, very young, one of our first attempts was a class through the Cerebral Palsy Organization back in Alberta. And because all the children have physical disabilities in this program, it's very easy to notice right away that in our case, our child is the child that is most disabled, if I can call it this way, from all the children. And when you are a parent at the beginning of this kind of disability life, it is very, very intimidating. If your child does not fit in the activity, specifically, not just for kids with disabilities, but for kids with cerebral palsy, where else in this world would they fit? Mm-hmm. And it's a big, big question. It's very intimidating. And now in retrospect, I know how that program could have fitted my daughter as well. The problem was that the teachers back then didn't know how to make it accessible for a kid who couldn't move their legs, their hands, their head, and answer verbally to questions. With experience, I knew how to help others modify the program and how to include my daughter. But at that time, I think the greatest effect of that class was by depressing my husband and myself to the core, by feeling that, you know, this is like a huge door was just closing on the cave that we were in, outside of society, and that we would never allowed in, and that our child would never have the experience to, you know, be a part of, let's say, normal childhood and what it entails. So when people are busy with programming, my advice is think of the worst case scenario. Mm-hmm. How would a child participate in an activity if they are completely paralyzed? How would a child who's blind, but not just with partial view, but who's completely blind, how would they benefit from this class? How would you include someone who's hard of hearing or completely deaf, etc.? And if you challenge yourself with those scenarios and go through the different aspects and try to modify the activity, I guarantee your chances of successes are greater no matter who walks in the door. And the main guideline that I always like to share is ask the parents.
Yes.
A child with a disability would never just show up by themselves and be and, you know, expect to be served. There would always be an adult. Ask as many questions as you can. You would learn so much from that. Be open for suggestions and let the parents also, if they are able to participate and support, at least at the beginning, until you are able to independently take their role and support the child on your own.
Yes, and I think that's an excellent point. And unfortunately, I think that there's a lot of hubris on the part of people who run programs. Oh, I've dealt with this for years. I know how to, and that is something that the ego needs to leave. The ego needs to be out the door, because when there's an ego involved, it's a red flag to parents, because if you're not asking questions to the parents, we can't feel safe. And it is definitely a red flag. And I wish that I had known that red flag when I sent my son to a sleepaway camp that I had heard was great for so many kids who had disabilities. So I decided to send my son, and when I started to tell them about his behaviors and that he could escalate, with certain triggers, they kind of poo-pooed it. And they were like, oh, we've been dealing with, you know, with these kind of behavioral issues for years. We know all about it. And I was like, all right, this is awesome. You know, I was like, all right, bye-bye. And I so I was ready to party. I started getting the calls almost immediately from the camp. And like you, Iris, it set me back probably years. It put me into a very bad state where I had finally come to terms with, okay, well, my son's going to be in a program, a camp for kids with disabilities. That was a hurdle itself, that, okay, I guess my son's going to have to go to this camp for kids with disabilities, because he was kicked out of the typical camps. And I think that for a lot of parents in the very beginning, for a lot of parents, their kids can kind of manage in typical settings. And then there comes a point when the kids get a little bit older that the behaviors start becoming a little more extreme. And we have to come to terms with the fact that, all right, they're they can't be in these regular programs. So we brace ourselves and we're like, all right, I guess that he can only go to a, you know, a program for kids with disabilities or a camp for kids with disabilities. He's not going to make it in the regular camps. So he went to a camp for kids with disabilities. I came to terms with that. It was depressing for me. It made me sad, but I was on board. We started getting the calls almost immediately asking, well, what do we do in this situation? What do we do in that situation? And they were very simple situations that one would hope a program that is designed for children of all this, you know, all disabilities and, you know, touted as an inclusive program would know how to deal with these behavioral issues for young children. Long story short, the calls kept coming. They kept coming and coming and coming until one day they said, you need to come pick him up today. So we had to drive 2.5 hours and go pick up our son, which was so awful. And I still have a chip on my shoulder to this day about this camp, because I believe that if a camp or any program says that it's inclusive, to your point, Iris, they need to be prepared for any kind of a disability, and not just the easy disabilities that don't require much intervention. And that seems to be a very, very common problem for, quote unquote, inclusive programs, that it's inclusive, but only for the easiest of disabilities to deal with. And it's not fair to the parents. It's a waste of time. It's a waste of money. And mostly it is painful for the child who then has to leave the program, and for the parents who kind of put their trust in these programs. And it's hard not to feel like, you know, they wanted our money. They didn't take it seriously, that they're not really focused on the child with the disability if they're not going to be truly inclusive. So it's a hard road. It's a hard road. And I did try to advocate quite a bit. And I told them how unhappy I was that this was not inclusive, and that they need to have more experience. So that was my advocacy in the program. But it was, you know, I tried while he was there. And this happened twice in two separate camps that called themselves inclusive and did all the things that triggered my son to behave in a certain way that we had told them these are his triggers, and they were done anyway, and he got kicked out. So it's setting up kids for failure, and it's really unfortunate.
Yeah, I think that the word inclusive is being used very loosely. It reminds me of the all access playground, you exactly. know, that drove me insane, basically. Mm-hmm. It just do not use those terms loosely, and don't mm-hmm. exclude kids that are anyway excluded from all other activities in society from mm-hmm. your inclusive camp because they're too disabled. This yeah. is really adding an insult to an injury. It's just not right. So mm-hmm. when you use that terminology, if you're hoping to provide a program that is inclusive, do your homework. That's my yeah. comment.
Do your homework.
Mm-hmm. I want to give a couple of examples of places and programs that did it well. And one of them was meant specifically for kids with disabilities. It was hosted by the New York City Ballet. It's a program for children with cerebral palsy that allowed them to dance. And we showed up in that program, obviously, one day with Karen, with all of her kind of needs, etc. And we participated, and it was lovely. But what was more lovely is that at the end of this program, those workshops are hosted. Usually there are a couple of New York City Ballet, like they're top dancers, like nothing but they're kind of like principal dancers and soloist ballerinas. It's just amazing. But one of the two instructors, her name is Ashley Larcy, became curious, and she came to ask us about Karen because she's never seen a child in a gait trainer. And she started asking questions. And from her questions, A, developed an amazing friendship, but B, she basically changed the whole program and how it was taught because she learned how to understand Karen's abilities and disabilities. Mm-hmm. So she would then provide those workshops, and she would ask the students to not just stretch their hands, but to stretch any organ of their body that they're capable of stretching. If you can stretch your neck, stretch your neck. If you can stretch your legs, stretch your legs. And then she gave room for, you know, the kids to explore what they can move and what they couldn't, they didn't. And she would also add exercises that included the eyes. And if you could roll your eyes and also roll your head while you're rolling your eyes, then you can do so. So Karen would actually be able to participate with the parts of the body that she could move and mm-hmm. do things independently. And that was so beautiful to me. And it put the emphasis on so many different things while she was teaching ballet. It was just amazing, because for someone who's so in their body, that their body is the instrument of expression for them, to be able to interact with Karen, my daughter, and all the other kids with disabilities that were there, whose body is their, I guess, hardest hurdle in life sometimes. Mm-hmm. It's just, it was heartwarming. And I hope that other instructors, no matter if the program is specifically for kids with disabilities or open to the general population, would come into the scene with the same
open mind.
Yeah, curiosity and the same eagerness to understand and to accommodate. Mm-hmm. And I'll give you another example later about how it was done in a program that was meant for typical children and how they included Karen, but I'll go back to you first.
Well, I want to give another positive example. And it again, it has to do with the person who's working in the program asking questions, but not just asking the questions, because many people ask questions, but then they don't take the information and are not consistent with what the needs are and addressing those needs. So we had a wonderful woman who unfortunately was laid off during COVID at our local YMCA, and she dealt with all the programming for the kids who were members at the YMCA. I wanted Lincoln to be involved in these programs. And she came to me and I said, he can't participate. She would always say, you know, this is a new program we're doing. And I would say, he can't do it because he needs to be supervised. She went out of her way to find interns, kids who were doing community service at the Y or who worked there to stay with him when all the other kids had no parents with them. I didn't feel comfortable with him being there without me, but she hired interns who worked with him and made sure that he didn't feel that he was being babysat, that he was like one of the other kids, and they used his strengths, like what you're talking about with Karen. Her strengths were that she could move her eyes and she could participate in that way. He liked having a role of helping, being a helper. So she created this little role for him where he could help the younger kids, and he was safe and he was feeling productive and a part of this program. And it was amazing that he was able to do it. And it was so simple. It was such a simple way to have him be included. And you know, it can be done, but it has to be the organizer asking questions, being open to maybe figuring out ways to do this, creative problem solving, and to be consistent about it. So that was one positive. That shout out to Kimberly.
So I
said shout out to Kimberly for making that happen at our local YMCA.
Yeah, I wanted to give another example of an activity that was meant for kids who are able-bodied, but my daughter wanted to participate because my son did it, mm-hmm. and that was a judo class. So for anyone who doesn't know anything about judo, I'll just say that it's as close as you can be in terms of Japanese martial arts to wrestling. That's a very physical sport in which you're in close contact with another person and seem intuitively like the worst place to include a child with quadriplegic cerebral palsy. But the lucky thing for us was that Gali Amit, the judo instructor that we were working with back then, or had a training already on how to work with kids with disabilities. And he just did a phenomenal job having Karen in the group. He managed to somehow include her in the activities, the things that she was able to do in her gait trainer, let's say running a little bit at the beginning of class or moving from one side of the gym to the other while the kids were doing the warm-ups was great. Later on, when we took her out of her her gait trainer, she's basically like a blob of like, you know, body organs that are not very coordinated, and she can't even sit independently or stand. So I was a part of the class, I would support her, but he managed to include her and make life easier for her and myself by kind of rotating the class around her and including her in the activity sometimes passively, and also modifying exercises to fit her by using her weight rather than her physical ability, and would have the smarts to kind of, once she was out of the gait trainer, to make the kids come to her. And if he had to stop and give an explanation, it was always standing next to Karen because Karen couldn't move towards him. So he would come to her and all the other kids had to kind of organize themselves around her. So it was the attention of the little things, the acceptance of what is as is, and allowing it to, or Karen in this situation, to be in the class and understanding that the goals of her being in the class are 100% different than the goals of all the other children. And that that is still okay, because she wanted to be a part and she would never become an Olympic judoka. It was clear to everybody, also to the other kids, but she was a part of it with her friends and her brother, and she was as happy as can be. So I just want to say, as a kind of a general message, that sometimes the title of the class is just a title. Mm-hmm. What's important is that it's inclusive and that you open the doors for kids, no matter their abilities and no matter what the end result or learning objective at the end would be.
And you reminded me of the tap dancing class that I took with Lincoln that I've talked about in a previous podcast episode here, but we had a wonderful tap dance teacher who, again, the goals were different for everybody. You know, there were some tap routines that Lincoln couldn't do or couldn't do, you know, as quickly or as, you know, well as the other people in the class, but he was having fun and he was doing it. And he did a lot more than, honestly, than I thought that he was going to be capable of learning. But the teacher, Jean-Luc is his name, and he really, he just allowed Lincoln to be who he was in the class and treated him like everybody else. And that was one place where I didn't have to advocate in a program. And it was really important to us. And we've got to get back to that class. Our Monday evenings are too busy at the moment, but we will get back to that class. And so I think that the theme here is just, if you're going to say that you're inclusive as a program, make sure that you actually are inclusive to the best of your ability. And the only way that you're going to learn how to do it is by talking to the child, to the parent. And there's always a way. I think that what we've learned in this episode is that there is always a way.
When there is a will, there is a
way. When there's a will, there's a way. So if people
break the program.
What'd you say?
People make the program.
That's right.
If you have an instructor that is willing and able, then the program is worthy. Back to the program.
Yeah, it can be done. If the program organizers are willing to take the time to make it, to truly make it inclusive, it can be done. So please don't be dejected and feel rejected if you are told that you cannot participate. As frustrating and sad and painful as it might be, you got to get in there and say, how about trying this? How about trying that? maybe we can get an intern from somewhere else, a student to participate with my child to make sure that they can, you know, work with them and to participate in whatever the program is. There really is a way to make every program inclusive. So keep your mind open, keep your eyes on the prize of making things happen for your child, and basically do not take no for an answer.
Alma, as always, it's been a pleasure. I learned so much from you.
I learned so much from you.
Yeah, I'm so happy we got to talk about this important topic. I hope that people would later share with us their experiences and their smarts about how to make programs more inclusive. If you want to write to us, please do so at info@twomomsnofluff. And also, if you want to receive our
newsletter.
Yes, sorry, I forgot the name. Our newsletter, monthly newsletter, please also use info@twomomsnofluff, and we'll be happy to share it with you on a monthly basis. I think that the comments and suggestions and questions that we get from other parents are the fuel in our engine and what makes us going, and gives us a lot of material to do our episodes about. So please don't hesitate to write to us, and rate us, please, also, because that brings more and new listeners into our podcast.
But only if you rate us with 5 stars. Don't go give us 1 star or 0 stars. We want 5 stars.
Alma, thank you, and I'll see you next week.
Thank you, Iris. See everybody next week.
Bye-bye.
Bye. For more information, please go to www.twomomsnofluff.com. Thank you.
If you like this podcast, please subscribe and give it a 5-star rating so more people can hear it. Thank you.